As I think some or probably most of you know, when I graduated from the from college through ROTC, I was commissioned as an infantry officer, and I always enjoyed training, especially with doing live fire training exercises. As a young infantry lieutenant, platoon leader, you work your way through training. Some of you know this, having been in the military. You start out doing dry fire exercises, then you use blanks. And the culmination, the most exciting thing, is you get to use live ammunition and explosives and hand grenades and all that stuff. And it's the most fun part of what you get to do. But on one such training exercise, and this was obviously many years ago, I was the platoon leader for an infantry platoon, and we were training together with an artillery unit, the people who drop bombs, right? So artillery unit, and with the big guns, the howitzers. And during our planning and preparations for this particular mission, as the infantry officer leading the assault, I was the first one to go like onto the objective. I had to coordinate with the artillery officer to make sure everything was in sync. That's important, right? You want to make sure that like you're not going where he's shooting. You want to make sure he stops shooting before you go where he was shooting, all those sorts of things, and you're coordinating well and making sure you're all together in sync. So we met together, we made our plans, we coordinated a start and end of the time for his bombing, after which I would lead my men onto the ground that he had just bombed. And at the conclusion of our plans, this artillery officer said to me, well, when we fired our last round, I'll call to you, round's complete, and that's how you'll know you can go. We're done. I said, great. And before you start bombing, I'll call you and tell you we're in place to make sure, you know, you don't start before we're ready, because we want to make sure we're safe. So, okay, we'll do that. But then another question came to my mind before we broke up and went our separate ways. I said, but how will we know when the shelling has started? What, you know, what's going to everybody signal that you started bombing? And he just looked at me and he said, don't worry, you'll know. And I actually didn't get it at the time. I was like, how will I know? I mean, I bet we're all professionals here. I'm sure there's something he's going to do to let me know and to help me figure out, you know, when the bombing has started. Well, everything was going according to plan as we were getting ready to go. And we got to our place. I called to him, say, hey, we're where we're supposed to be. You know, go ahead. And when you're in a position like that, waiting and the adrenaline's running and you're getting ready to go, like a minute seems like an hour. And so I started thinking, what's happening? Where is he? I walked over to my RTO, that had the radio telephone operator. I was about to call the artillery officer and say, what's going on? When all of a sudden, boom! And I hit the ground, and the RTO hit the ground next to me, and I looked over his face, and he could see the shock in his eyes, and I must have had a strange look on my face, too, because he said, why are you smiling? And I said, I get it now. We'll know. He was right. It's probably safe to say that there are very few passages in the scriptures that have been subject to more speculation, more theorizing, and more angst-laden pontification than the Olivet Discourse. And Jesus' teaching, as recorded in the text that we're coming to today in Mark chapter 13. This is called the Olivet Discourse because the sermon Jesus delivers on the Mount of Olives. And it can be perplexing. It is perplexing. But the reason that so many people get off track and is because they approach this text and the other parallel passages that you find in the other Gospels that are like this as if it is some cryptic prophecy that is trying to give us specific dates and times and events. And so what happens is you start reading into it things that aren't there, and you start making predictions, looking at the news, and then trying to funnel those things in through this text, and you go way off track. And the main point, what we're going to see this morning, particularly this week, but mostly next week, Jesus does reference at least one specific event, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. And that is something we know that he predicted, and that has happened. But the main point of this entire teaching of the coming of the Son of Man, of Jesus' second coming, of his return, is this. Don't worry. Don't worry. If you come away from this chapter full of angst, full of worry and anxiety, you've read it wrong. Because Jesus actually tells us, the reason I'm telling you this is so you won't worry. And the main point of the portion that we're going to be looking at this morning is, don't worry about trying to figure out the exact timing of Jesus' return. It will be so great, so powerful, so overwhelming, so universally awe-inspiring that you're going to know when it happens. You won't miss it. You'll know. And when it does happen, when Jesus comes again to judge the earth and gather His elect from the four corners of the earth, we'll most likely be looking at each other with smiles on our face and saying, He was right. You'll know. You see, Jesus' teaching in Mark 13 naturally falls into three sections. And if you look in your bulletin, I've outlined this for us there, if you like, on page 6. There's a couple of things there that are unique. We don't always put this in the bulletin, but this is helpful, I think, hopefully, to see what we're doing and where we're going. I've listed the outline of passage, and so you see in the middle section, verses 24 through 27, you have a description of Jesus' second coming, the coming of the Son of Man. And then, of course, in the verses leading up to that, we have the prelude to the coming of the Son of Man. And then after His teaching on, or His describing the second coming, at the end of this chapter, we have what I'm calling the ramifications of the coming of the Son of Man. That is how we, as believers, ought to think and behave until He comes back. It's instruction for us of how, what we're supposed to be thinking and doing until Jesus returns. So these are the three basic sections that we're going to be spending the next 4 weeks in. But the first 2 weeks, we're going to be looking at this first section, verses 1 through 23. And you can see the outline I've listed of the sermons plan that I have planned for that as well. But let's look at our text this morning, beginning in Mark chapter 13. If you remember, Jesus has just finished answering questions and teaching in the temple, and now they're on their way out of the temple, and the disciples start marveling at the structure of this temple. They're kind of like tourists. They're kind of, whoa, look at all this stuff. And, you know, it's like the, you know, what is it? The kind of, look at those tall buildings and from the country people coming into town, right? But they're looking at this wonderful building in the temple, and they're marveling at it. So look what happens. Mark chapter 13, verse 1. As He was going out of the temple, one of His disciples said to Him, "Teacher, behold what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings." And Jesus said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left upon another which will not be torn down." And He was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple. Peter and James and John and Andrew were questioning Him privately. "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign when all these things are going to be fulfilled?" Okay, let's just stop here for a minute. As they're leaving the temple, the disciples are marveling at this great architecture, the buildings. But Jesus takes the wind out of their sails. You see all that? It's all coming down. Not one stone. It's all coming down. Now, in order to understand the full weight of what Jesus was saying, and as a guiding principle for the rest of what we're going to see in this chapter, we have to get into the heads of the disciples and think about what it would be like in that time, in that place, as a Jewish Christian, a follower of Christ, before the temple fell, and you're looking forward to all these prophecies that have been foretold in the Old Testament. You see, for the disciples, they thought that the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem would come at the end of the world. That is, the temple would never be destroyed. So if it was destroyed, that's the end of the world. And so Jesus is, in their eyes, Jesus must be talking here about the end of the age and the full realization of His kingdom, the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God. If the temple is destroyed, that's the end. There's nothing else that follows that. And so, after Jesus tells them that this temple will be destroyed, they go up on the mount, and the Mount of Olives there, and they're sitting up on the hillside looking down at the temple, a nice quiet moment to themselves, and Jesus is speaking with His inner circle. Did you notice? It's with Peter and James and John and Andrew. And they ask two questions. It looks like one, but they're asking two questions. When will these things be? And what will be the sign when all these things are going to be fulfilled? When will this happen? And how will we know that it's happening? When will this happen? And how will we know that it's happening? And here's where you have to think like the disciples. When the disciples, they assume that the destruction of the temple would coincide with the coming of the Son of Man in all His glory. And that's the end of the age. And so this is critical. And if you want to understand Matthew, the Olivet Discourse, here in Mark chapter 13. So don't miss this. In the disciples' mind, when Jesus is talking about the destruction of the temple, they're thinking, end of the world. Now, because we live after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, which occurred around 70 AD, about 40 years after Jesus prophesied that it will be destroyed, we know the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem does not coincide with the end of the world. Right? We know that. We can make that assumption. But in the minds of the disciples, these two concepts, the destruction of the temple and the end of the world, are commingled. For the disciples, they are one and the same event. And so when Jesus answers, He commingles the two as well. And this is actually one of the main reasons why the Olivet Discourse, why Jesus' teaching on the Mount of Olives about His second coming can be so confusing. We have to keep this principle in mind. When Jesus tells the disciples about the destruction of the temple and the end of the age, that is, the coming of the Son of Man, He is speaking about shadow and reality at the same time. Okay, this is key to understanding this passage. He's speaking about shadow, the destruction of the temple, and reality, His second coming, at the same time. Because, you see, the destruction of the temple is merely a shadow of the things to come for the church, the people of God, leading up to the return of Christ and the end of the age. So in the first section of the Olivet Discourse, you'll notice in verses 5 through 23, he's teaching about the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem at the same time as he's describing the end of the world, or his second coming. He speaks to the disciples about things they can understand, things they can see and touch, namely the temple in Jerusalem with all of its trappings. Jesus talks about the things that they can understand in order to teach them about things that they don't understand, his second coming. So let me see if this helps to help explain this, because this is such a key principle, I think, in understanding this. Think about the temple, if you would, as a shadow box. We have a full solar eclipse coming up, right, in April, right? Is that right? Sometime, I don't know. Ask all the tourist facilities. Like, they're getting ready. There's lots of people coming to this area, apparently, because we're right in the swath. Swatch? We're in the path of the solar eclipse, right? So, anyway, if you want to look at the solar eclipse, you don't look at the sun, right? Third grade, remember that. Don't look at the sun. You'll go blind. So you need a shadow box of some kind or something. Maybe you can get those glasses. But you can make your own little shadow box, right? And the shadow box allows you to see the solar eclipse reflected there in your shadow box, right? There's a pinhole and it shines through and you can see it in that way. I remember making one in the 70s. There was some kind of solar eclipse. We all went out at recess and watched it with the shadow box. Now think about this. Before Christ came, the temple operated as a shadow box. It was a reflection, a shadow of Christ, the real thing. And so the people of God, the Old Covenant, they could not yet see Christ, but they could see His reflection, His shadow, in the shadow box of the temple. And the whole sacrificial system that was attached to the temple. So you think about, you have this shadow box of the temple, and then when Christ comes, there's the reality of all the things in the Old Testament, the shadow box of the temple pointed to Him, the reality. He was casting that shadow, right? But now the real thing has come. And now, as Jesus describes His second coming, the same thing is happening. In the way you should think about the temple, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem is a shadow box of Jesus' second coming, the reality of what is to come. The return to judge the earth and save His people when He comes in all His glory and bringing the fullness of His kingdom. So in the Olivet Discourse, you'll notice Jesus is using language that the disciples can understand by speaking about the destruction of the temple. He's talking about the shadow box in order to teach them about His second coming, the reality. So these two questions from the disciples, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign of the coming of the Son of Man, these two questions set the course, really, for the remainder of this sermon in Mark chapter 13. Okay, so all we talked about here is by way of introduction so we can better understand this text. But it's very important to keep this in mind when you're reading about Jesus' teaching here in the Olivet Discourse. When he teaches them about the second coming of Christ, he also includes prophecies concerning the destruction of Jerusalem, which is actually the shadow, or the temple in Jerusalem, which is actually the shadow that points to the reality of his second coming. So now, let's look at the rest of this text. We're going to spend 2 weeks on this section that I've called Prelude to the Coming of the Son of Man. But let's read this first section beginning in verse 5. Mark chapter 13, verse 5, and we'll read through verse 23. And Jesus began to say to them, "See to it that no one misleads you. Many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he,' and will mislead many. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be frightened. Those things must take place, but that is not yet the end. For nation will rise up against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will also be famines. These things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. But be on your guard, for they will deliver you to the courts, and you will be flogged in the synagogues, and you will stand before governors and kings for my sake as a testimony to them. The gospel must first be preached to all the nations. When they arrest you and hand you over, do not worry beforehand about what you are to say, but say whatever is given you in that hour, for it is not you who speak, but it is the Holy Spirit. Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents and have them put to death. You will be hated by all because of my name, but the one who endures to the end, he will be saved. But when you see the abomination of desolation standing where it should not be, let the reader understand that those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. The one who is on the housetop must not go down or go in to get anything out of his houses, or out of his house. And the one who is in the field must not turn back to get his coat. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. But pray that it may not happen in the winter. For those days will be a time of tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the creation which God created until now and never will. Unless the Lord had shortened those days, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect whom he chose, he shortened the days. And then if anyone says to you, 'Behold, here is the Christ,' or 'Behold, he is there,' do not believe him. For false Christ and false prophets will arise and will show signs and wonders in order to lead astray, if possible, the elect. But take heed. Behold, I have told you everything in advance." Now, some of you no doubt might be thinking, what in the world is the abomination of desolation and why is it in the wrong place? All right? What's it doing there? Well, we'll talk about that next week a bit more. But today I want to focus our attention really on the beginning and the end of this section that we just read. And I want you to see how Jesus frames his description of the signs and events leading up to his second coming with this point. You're going to hear a lot of talk. People are going to try and mislead you. Some will claim actually to be the Christ, the Messiah. Some will claim that they know where he is, that they've actually seen him. There are going to be a bunch of false Christs and a bunch of false prophets that will do all sorts of things to try and lead astray the elect, if at all possible. I don't know if you remember during Y2K, but I remember seeing I don't know if it was called the Jesus Cam or the Messiah Cam. I think it was the Jesus Cam. It was set up on the Mount of Olives, and you actually could go online and watch it in case you missed Jesus' second coming. There was a camera that you could watch set up remotely there because he was going to come back to the Mount of Olives and split it and all this stuff, right? Like you need a camera, and you're going to miss it or something. But notice, Jesus says that this is precisely the reason why he's foretelling these events. So look at verse 23 again. He says, "But take heed, behold, I have told you everything in advance." He started off back in verse 7 saying, "Don't be afraid of all these rumors." And at the end he says, "Be on guard against the liars and deceivers." You're going to be tempted to think that the end has come, Jesus says. But don't be fooled. These are the beginning of birth pangs, the beginning of the rebirth, of the regeneration, of the cosmos. Look again at the beginning section, verses 5 through 8. Look at Mark 13, verse 5. And Jesus began to say to them, "This, see to it, no one misleads you. Many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he,' and will mislead many. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be frightened. Those things must take place, but that is not yet the end. For nation will rise up against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will also be famines. These things are merely the beginning of birth pangs." War and natural disasters will come, Jesus says. But these are the beginnings of birth pangs. And because of that, you're going to hear all sorts of strange things. You might even be tempted to become fearful and fret and be deceived yourself. But I'm telling you these things in advance, Jesus says, so that you will know and you will not be afraid. I'm telling you these things in advance so that you will be on guard and not be led astray. So the point here is this. If you, as a believer in Christ, as a child of God, as a disciple, one of God's elect, if you hear someone making specific predictions about the second coming of Christ based upon their interpretations of wars and natural disasters, do not be afraid. Jesus told us in advance that these things would happen and that they're just the beginning of birth pangs. In fact, we've been in the beginning of birth pangs for about 2,000 years now. I went on Amazon.com this past week to kind of do some looking around to see what's out there. And I tried to look up some books that have been written by so-called prophecy experts, people who think they can predict and interpret the signs of the times and figure out when Jesus came back is going to come back. And I messed up my whole Amazon algorithm. So now I'm getting like emails. You probably would like this book. No, I wouldn't. Anyway, I'm getting all the John Hagee books sent to me now. But there's so many. I gave up looking. You find one, and you scroll down, you might also be interested in this book. And then it's like a never-ending, like, this book after book after book. So I even found a book by John Hagee that seems to be keep getting revised based on the events that unfold. You know, if we were wrong, so we're going to, oh, now this is happening, so we're going to change it, we're going to update. Got to keep updating your prophecy as events unfold. And I think they made it into a movie, actually. But here's the tagline and the summary from the most recent edition of this book. "There will soon be a nuclear blast in the Middle East that will transform the road to Armageddon into a racetrack." I mean, you can almost hear Jesus warning you, don't listen to that. Anyway, he keeps going. "America and Israel will either take down Iran or Iran will become nuclear in an attempt to take down America and Israel. In this powerful new updated edition, you will discover the identities of the key players in a world-changing nuclear showdown. The role of Russia, China, Europe, and America in the coming nuclear war. Why Israel's war with Hezbollah was only a preview of coming events. And fourth, God's plan and purpose for his people in the coming crisis." Then I stumbled across a recent article by Greg Laurie. Some of you know him. You've seen him on TV, right? He is called "War in Israel, A Fulfillment of Bible Prophecy?" Now, I think this is fascinating. The title ends with a question mark, which is a favorite way I've found of prognosticators to kind of hedge their bets. I never made the statement. You saw the question mark, right? So you read things like that and you'll notice people don't speak in indicatives. They always speak in interrogatives. They're always asking questions like, could it be that as this unfolds, we're seeing this happen? Anyway, in Greg Laurie's article, "War in Israel, A Fulfillment of Bible Prophecy?" In light of the recent war that's going on now between Israel and in Gaza, right? He writes this. "If you get up in the morning and read this headline, 'Russia attacks Israel,' fasten your seatbelt because you're seeing Bible prophecy fulfilled in your lifetime before your very eyes." I kind of think of it like this. It's like a woman who's 5 months pregnant, right? And she begins to have contractions and they're about 2 hours apart. And her husband flips out. Lies her down on the couch and he gets the hot water, get the towels, we're having a baby. And the wife has to slap her husband and say, calm down. The doctor told us this is what happens at times, you know, during the pregnancy. It's not time yet. We've still got some ways to go. Now, of course, we know Jesus could return at any second, right? Or he could return 10,000 years from now. We don't know, right? And trying to read the tea leaves or the signs of the times or what's happening on in Israel between Gaza is not going to get you anywhere. I'm as concerned as the next guy about America's role in the Middle East, mostly because I'm an American and I care about our country and its involvement in world affairs. But as a Christian, I am more concerned about the Church of Jesus Christ and who we are until Jesus comes back and what we're to be about. And even if and when fearful things happen like wars and natural disasters, we need to throw away all those so-called prophecy experts and listen to the words of Jesus himself. Do not be frightened. These are just the beginning of birth pangs. Do not be frightened. Look again at that last section that we read, verse 20, beginning of verse 21. Just those last three verses. Mark 13, verse 21. And then if anyone says to you, behold, here is the Christ, or behold, he is there, do not believe him. For false Christs and false prophets will arise, will show signs and wonders in order to lead astray, if possible, the elect. But take heed, behold, I have told you everything in advance. To draw upon Jesus' metaphor concerning the beginning of birth pangs, as Christians, we must turn away from these false Christs, false prophets, and recognize this fact. There has never been a time since Jesus spoke these words nearly 2,000 years ago, that there has not been wars and natural disasters. I don't know if you know this, there was a Y1K, right? when the first millennium was over. And then there was a Y2K. It's just going to keep happening. We have been in the beginning of birth pangs for a very long time. But take heed, Jesus said, behold, I have told you everything in advance. I started this morning by telling you about an training mission from my early Army days in which we used live ammunition. On another mission experience occasion, we were on a very similar training exercise. We were practicing to attack an enemy who had dug in a defense, and they had concertina wire surrounding the objective. And again, this was training. There wasn't a real enemy, but we were using live ammunition, so it was fun. My platoon was tasked to secure the breachhead, which means we were supposed to be the first ones through the wire, kind of establish, secure it, and then about 100 other men would file, the rest of the company would come in through us, right, pass by us, and then finish the attack. And in order to accomplish this mission of reaching through the wire, a squad of engineers was attached to my infantry platoon, so about six guys were attached to my platoon, and their job was to sneak up to the wire real stealthily, right, and slide explosives underneath the wire, and then blow a hole in the wire. We would come rushing through after they blew that hole through the wire. Here's what happened. It wasn't funny at the time, but now in retrospect, looking back, it's kind of funny. It was frustrating at the time, but here's what happened. In the pre-dawn light, we all crept up to this objective and the wire. We got as close as we could, and then I sent these engineers forward to go and put the explosives and get ready to blow the hole through the wire. And everything was going according to plan. We were going to kick off the attack. Everybody's waiting behind us when this was like the crucial thing. When that explosion went, then everything started happening. And so I sent them forward, and I told you how, you get kind of anxious and the adrenaline's going. And so after about 10 minutes, I thought, what is going on? Where are these engineers? Did they find the place? Are they getting things right? I don't even know what's going on. Well, thankfully, what happened? So then my commander starts calling me and asking me, what's going on? And I don't know. They're out there, right? So thankfully, they have a radio man of their own. And so I start calling the engineer RTO. Hey, what's going on? Oh, it'll be 10 more minutes. Okay. Call back to my commander. 10 more minutes. He calls me again. What's going on? I call him. But 5 more minutes. 5 more minutes. Keep going back and forth. So I'm like the go-between now, between the engineer RTO and my commander. And I'm calling back and forth. And then I start calling. 2 minutes. And then every time I called, it was 2 minutes. 2 more minutes. And I'm like, what? What is going on? Finally, I called him up. I said, for the last 20 minutes, it's been 2 minutes. Every time I call, you say it's 2 minutes. And just then, there was a tap on my shoulder, And it was the engineer's RTO, the guy who I'd been talking to on the radio. And I said, great, you're back. Are we ready? I didn't hear the explosion. You know, I learned my lesson. You'll know, right? But I didn't hear the explosion. He said, actually, sir, I didn't go forward with the engineers. I've been behind you the whole time. He was just making it up. Oh, it'd be about 2 minutes. And I don't know. Some private, he didn't want to get in trouble, and they forgot to take him along with him. So I'm talking to a guy that's not even there and doesn't even know what's going on. And then I turn around, and I see the engineers running, fire in the hole. Now we're all caught off guard because I don't know what's going on, and it's delayed, and we weren't ready for the attack because I've been distracted by a guy who was leading me astray on the radio, not knowing what was happening. The actions of that radio man is exactly what Jesus is talking about in this passage when he warns us about false Christs and false prophets. It's very easy to get distracted by people who say, look at that sign. Look over what's happening over there in Iran, in Russia, in Israel, or wherever they want to point. Look at what our government is up to in the United States. I see the mark of the beast. It's right there. It's coming. I see it. Look what's happening over there. Surely this is the end. When all the time they're like that RTO in the back, they don't know what they're talking about. They're just making it up. But we can be so easily led astray and distracted, looking for signs and listening to prognosticators and predictors and conspiracy theorists, when in actuality those prognosticators and predictors and conspiracy theorists don't have a clue about when Jesus is coming back or the timing of the last day. In 3 weeks, when we look at the end of the Olivet Discourse, we're going to see how Jesus makes a very surprising revelation. It's probably not surprising anymore because we've heard it so many times if you've been in the church, but it would be surprising when you think about this is the Son of God saying this. But of that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. So if no one knows, if the angels don't know, if Jesus himself doesn't seem to know the date of the last day, then why in the world would we think that we or someone else can figure it out by reading the signs of the times? So if you hear of wars and rumors of wars and natural disasters, don't be afraid, Jesus says. These are just the beginning of birth pangs, all within the bounds of God's sovereignty and all within the bounds of his providence. If you hear someone claim to be able to read the signs and make predictions, don't believe them. Don't be led astray. Take heed. Jesus has told us everything in advance. Don't worry. You'll know. Let's pray.